The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
These are the sounds of crushed souls. The sounds of despair from former radio personalities, languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
Helping you cope with the news by laughing at it, I hope you consider helping me keep them going by subscribing to my Patreon. For as little as $2 a month, you get extra content and bonus goodies, as well as the satisfaction of knowing you're supporting the arts. Well, at least this artist. Thanks.
There you go, our pal Lauren Mayer, getting us started on this Wednesday. And I saved that one for today, knowing that Lisa Graves would be joining us today. And I thought that's the perfect intro. Because, you know, I like to start the show with a silly parody song. Usually that is somewhat relatable to what we're going to be talking about when that works out. And today, certainly it did. And I say welcome back to Lisa Graves. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Nicole. Thank you so much for having me on and letting me dial in by phone.
No worries at all. So Lisa Graves is, where are you? You're on the road. You're traveling in a hotel somewhere?
I'm in Philadelphia, and there's a lot of sound outside my window, so hopefully you can still hear me.
I hear you just fine, and sometimes hotels have spotty Wi-Fi or whatever, so yes, so you're on the phone, which, you know, after all, this is, at heart, a radio show. The video, I do because people like to watch, to quote Chance the Gardener, and so I try to accommodate, but you know, I'd prefer audio only. It would be much easier on me and I'd have fewer technical problems, but whatever, it's 2024 and I'm trying to keep up with the times. So I don't know if you
this hotel only has common broadband for everyone. So I just think it's bandwidth issues, but thank you so much for the accommodation. I appreciate it.
Oh, no worries. Thank you for being here. For those who don't know, you know, I realize that I have you on a lot, and I don't often, or I should say I don't always, explain what makes you such a great person to talk to about all things legal, but you've got the, as they say, bona fides. You are a lawyer, but you don't practice. You've never been in private practice, have you?
I did work for law firms in college and in during law school, but I didn't ever work for a private firm after I graduated from law school.
Gotcha. But you did work at the Justice Department. You worked under both Attorneys General Janet Reno and John Ashcroft in the Clinton and W administrations, right? You worked in the Senate Judiciary Committee, helping out with nominations, which is a hefty job, at least when there's a Democrat in office, because we saw the kind of nominations for the judiciary that Trump put through, and I don't think they did much vetting of those judges.
No, I mean I worked on the Judiciary Committee during George W. Bush's first in office, and so I saw a lot of people who I didn't think were qualified for lifetime jobs as judges then, and then it was almost like Trump doubled down on the lack of quality of some of the nominees, or how partisan and extreme they were. Although there were a lot of extreme people, in my view, who were nominated by George W. Bush, because they were all people who, not all of them, but many of them were people who were part of the Federal Society, were people who Leo and his cohorts wanted to capture the courts and, in my view, destroy our rights.
And when I remember, I was doing this back then. We were talking back then when Bush was in office, and you know, I remember thinking, well, it can't get any worse than this. but it seems like there's no basement when it comes to today's Republican Party. I thought we hit rock bottom with George W. Bush, someone who was not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, and surrounded himself with not very good people, and got us into a war that we had no business being in. You know, we could go on and on about all the Bush stuff, and then Trump comes along, and you go, where are we? What planet are we on? But I was reading, so we don't talk enough about your day job. And when you join us here on the show, Lisa Graves, you remind us, you come on in your own personal capacity with, you know, is your opinions, not as the founder and executive director of True North Research. But I would like you to put that hat on for a moment, if you don't mind. Because I was looking at the website, which is truenorthresearch.org, and it's a watchdog group. And how do you describe what True North Research is?
Well, we are a watchdog group. We're a national research group that focuses on the right-wing forces that are trying to limit progress, who are limiting our freedoms, and exposing that network both at the national level and the state level.
Right. So I check in there. Now, you also, where you were when we first met, you were at the Center for Media and Democracy. And are you president of the board there still?
I'm the president of the board of the Center for Media Democracy, and their main website is exposedbycmd.org.
Right. And they're the ones under your leadership that brought us Alec Exposed. And I remember that was the website, and the Koch brothers, I don't remember what the actual URL was.
Yeah, Coke Exposed.
Okay, duh. Yeah. All that. So we learned about the Koch brothers from you. I learned all about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, from you, because you brought them out into the open. And in recent years, I've learned all about Leonard Leo from you. He's like the king of dark money, right? Is that a good way to describe him? Self-professed.
That is a good way to describe it, but I must say that Jane Mayer really put the bright spotlight on the Kochs, but I was laboring along with Greenpeace and others to pull them into that spotlight. Raga is another group that we've taken a hard look at.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because right there, you don't have an article on, but you have some documents posted there at truenorthresearch.org on Raga. Now, I understand Heidi Prisbola, who does some really good stuff, she's a Politico now, reported on this group, and you're also doing a lot of work exposing who they are. On the surface, you would think the Republican Attorneys General Association wouldn't be like a fringe group that we had to keep our eyes on, except we have to go below the surface, don't we?
Well, yes, because, you know, they use the rhetoric of the rule of law, and yet they are advancing a really extreme agenda. And in fact, they've always been a pay-to-play operation since I first encountered them when I was a chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee about, you know, 2 decades ago, when we had a whistleblower who came forward with call records about the fact that these state attorneys general were calling industries that they would otherwise be, you know, in essence, regulating, trying their job as a top law enforcement officer of the state to enforce the state's consumer, you know, consumer rights and health and safety. But in fact, these AGs were calling, calling these corporations to solicit donations to RAGA, which then in turn would help fund their campaign.
Wow. Now, you know, these are the attorney general is the top law enforcement officer in terms of, you know, of the country. Merrick Garland is the nation's chief law enforcement official. State attorneys general are also, are they not, the state's chief law enforcement authority?
Yes, that is correct. They are the ones who they don't oversee every criminal prosecution. Those are handled at a county level or city level, but in terms of this, you know, statewide laws, particularly laws involving environmental regulation, you know, consumer rights and things like that, the attorney general have that leading role, and they also advise the governors on what's permissible for a governor to do or not do in their state, in addition to the governor's staff.
But the stuff that now you're helping to tell the story of is that these are pretty high level officials who have been involved in interventions in 2020, trying to overturn the results of the election, and now pushing for legislation in several states that would that let's just say don't comply with the letter of the law exactly, or the way the law is meant to be carried out.
Well, I would say that, you know, it's certainly the case that they have always, you know, these jobs in the states have been jobs where people run on a party ticket. But up until 1999, all of the attorneys general belonged to one organization, the National Association of Attorneys General, mm-hmm. NAAG, still around. But after the tobacco litigation and efforts to hold both the tobacco industry and the gun industry accountable for the live loss from their products, Republican Attorney General created their own separate group called RAGA, the Republican Attorney General Association, as we've mentioned. And that group has been increasingly political in the sense of intervening in elections like in 2020 and its members, I should say. And the ways in which they've intervened have been really disturbing. For example, the Republican Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, trying to stop other states from having their votes be counted in the 2020 election. And right. Then most notoriously, one of the arms of the Republican Attorneys General Association, one of the arms of RAGA, which is called the Rule of Law Defense Fund, RLDF, that group was doing robocalls and trying to spur people to go to Washington on January 6, 2020, for the rally that Trump said would be, quote, would be wild,
right.
The one where he incited the crowd to attack the Capitol, to fight, and ultimately that led to that violent insurrection on January 6th that resulted in the death and injury of numerous people.
Right. Again, there are attorneys general, chief law enforcement officers in a number of states who are actively working with insurrectionists, worked with Trump to try to overturn the results of a fair and free election. This, you know, reading this stuff, learning about this group, is it difficult for you to have faith in that our democracy will continue, that we can keep this thing going? Or do you have the same worry that I do, that the inmates have taken over the asylum?
Well, I am very concerned, very, very concerned. I mean, there was a really important story about 10 years ago, I think it was Mike McIntyre in the New York Times, who covered that RAGA, which for its first decade was part of this thing called the Republican State Leadership Committee, RSLC, had created its own 527 political organization in 2014, and that he described this pay-to-play process. We followed up on that story with a number of open records requests about what Raga was up to. What it was up to was attacking environmental laws, attacking our ability to mitigate climate change and more. And then, you know, during the Trump administration and at the end of the Trump administration, some of these AGs were actively trying to, in my view, stop the election, the just results, the duly certified results of the American people's vote from, you know, keeping Trump from remaining in office. And to me, it's an extraordinary set of acts by attorneys general, not just within their own state, but this aggressive attack on other states. And we've seen that a couple of times in the last couple of months, but in really extraordinary ways. So, for example, a number of these Republican attorneys general basically wrote to try to intimidate another attorney general, the attorney general of the District of Columbia, Brian Schwab, who began an investigation into Leonard Leo. Mm-hmm. And that investigation is because there has been a significant complaint that Leo is sending money or directing money to certain groups, and then they in turn are hiring his for-profit PR firm. And so he's, in essence, the allegation is that he's enriching himself through the groups he's funding with a nonprofit fund. And some of these AGs basically threatened Schwab and said, if you don't stop this investigation, we will have no choice but to investigate every civil rights group, every progressive immigration group, et cetera, when none of those groups have been alleged to have done the activity that Schwab is investigating. But that's not all. About a week or two ago, maybe it's been a week now, some of these same Republican attorneys general wrote a letter to the state of Maine attacking it for making efforts to ensure that people within the borders of Maine can access abortion and can access gender-affirming care. So you have these AGs, you know, really advancing Leonard Leo's agenda in many ways. And that's no surprise because Leonard Leo, through his network of groups, is the biggest funder of RAGA. It's sent RAGA more than $20 million over the past 10
years. Over $20 million. That's monopoly money. That's money that, you know, is inconceivable to the average person. But these are the kind of amounts we're talking. And when we're talking about big money, And the playground that Donald Trump is playing in, we've learned quite a few things about his wealth, or exaggerations about his wealth, in recent weeks. So last week, Lisa Graves, we're going to segue here a little bit to some of the news. Before we
segue,
can I say
one more thing? Real
yes,
quick
please. Yes.
Before I take my work hat off.
Yes.
You know, one of the documents that there have been several price documents that we've sought out from RAGA through open records requests. And then after I left the Center for Media Democracy, we were still pursuing RAGA. And you see these price sheets where it says, you know, for $10,000, you get, you know, this much access.
Oh,
you've got
one of these. Got the 2018 membership benefits posted at truenorthresearch.org. Spocko just put it up in the chat room, and I'm looking at it now. For, for $125,000 annual contribution, you can be in the Edmund Randolph Club, and it shows you all the benefits you get. So there's a lot of money passing through here, isn't there?
Well, that's right. And the key thing about that document is it says, if you're going to give us $200,000 or more, call us to see what you get.
Yes, details available upon request. Nod, wink, wink.
Here's a situation where Leonard Leo's network is giving RAGA more money than Koch Industries. It's giving it more money than the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And so what is Leonard Leo, through his group, getting with this kind of access? What he's getting is a number of Republican attorneys general who are writing brief to the Supreme Court, attacking Roe v. Wade, attacking the separation of church and state, attacking efforts to mitigate climate change, attacking the, you know, Chevron precedent involving judges being required to defer to agency expertise for reasonable regulations, and, you know, attack, in addition to this, you know, broader effort that we've seen from some of these state AGs who are, you know, assailing Impala, like in Idaho, where the attorney general there is, you know, refusing to allow women's health to be taken into account for emergency abortion women who are having miscarriages or partial miscarriages or otherwise need an abortion.
Yep.
You have what's happening in Texas, you know, in terms of this, the efforts there to try to restrict access to abortion. And so, you know,
I think that that's significant, where you have basically the top law enforcement officers in several states who are almost like a posse for one man, a private man who's never been, not that he's a public figure, but a person who's never been elected to anything, who no one has entrusted with this role to change the destiny of the United States in order to make us into this sort of theocratic nation, to impose his personal views as law against abortion, against gay rights, against government regulation of these corporations on climate change and more. And yet he's been very powerful in, having that impact because of this money. And that's one of the reasons why I was so happy to be on Dahlia's Amicus podcast to talk about this and Molly Dong Fast's podcast to talk about this, because it really is a story that hasn't broken through, but it is really having a big effect on our lives.
Right. And I love that Dahlia Lithwick called you up, because, you know, she's in my, in my orbit of like great legal minds, as are you. So I haven't heard it yet, but I'm going to have to go listen to that one over at Slate, is where Dahlia Lithwick is. So Lisa Graves, this does go to this money, this dark money world. So Donald Trump, this last week, was supposed to come up with $464 million or thereabouts, the amount of his judgment, if he wanted to appeal the civil award that was levied on him for the fraud he committed on New York State. So a couple of things happened. One is an appeals court came in and said, well, that's a lot of money. Why don't we'll knock it down to $175 million as the bond, so that, you can appeal it. And then, if you win, you haven't lost all of your property. Was that the reasoning?
I was shocked by that decision, and I just felt that it was really inappropriate. And in part because obviously the amount of the damages set by the court, that should be respected. It shouldn't be like basically negotiated down to benefit Trump. But also, it's appalling, these two standards of justice, in essence, where I'm sure some of your listeners listened to Amy on Democracy Now!
Amy
for
Goodman,
a number of years talking about Amy Goodman talking about. A young man who was held in the New York jails and, in Rikers for days and days and days because he couldn't post bail, himself, an ordinary person couldn't post bail. And he's not alone. In fact, in that case, it was a terrible tragedy for, I think it was Khalif Browder. But that's not the only person who gets held in jail in this country for not being able to post bail. Now, obviously, this is a civil case, in this particular instance, it's not a criminal case, but but if an ordinary person, can't post the full bail or the percentage of the bail to even get a bail, bail bonds and to help them get out, but they're stuck in jail. So why should Donald Trump get like a, two thirds discount on the amount of damages that he's been levied and in essence allowed this this reduced rate? But leaving aside that reduced rate that he got, in a way that I think is inappropriate and is unjust compared to other people who face bail or other sorts of, damages that they have to come forward with if they want to appeal. It's also a case of like this whole idea that this guy, and now I'm going to speak in my personal capacity, that this guy who claims he's a billionaire can't actually post his bail. It really, it really, again, underscores this question of how much Trump has lied about his potential wealth. And also how vulnerable he is for raising cash from various sources in order to shore up his overstated assets.
Right. So we saw in one instance so the money he had to come up with, the bond for the E. Jean Carroll case, so he can appeal that. The numbers are all just swimming around in my head. There was that big amount, and the $175 million that he had to come up with for the New York fraud case. Neither one of those came out of his pocketbook. He had somebody else pay the money. But do we know? We know that the guy who put up the money for the E. Jean Carroll case, I believe, if I have it straight, is one of the major shareholders in TikTok. The online social media company that Donald Trump, when he was in office, wanted to ban, but now all of a sudden he's changed his tune. Could there be some quid pro quo there?
Well, I don't know the details of like the surface company in terms of the bond or, you know, offering the bond. And then there is this separate issue of this meeting between Jeffrey Yass and Donald Trump.
Yes.
And Jeffrey Yass is the richest guy in Pennsylvania. And he's someone who part of his wealth has come from having this firm that engages in these, you know, rapid algorithmic trading operations. And so he's a billionaire who also is a billionaire in part because early on he invested funds in ByteDance, which is the parent
TikTok.
Company of TikTok. And so, as you point out, Nicole, one of the things that happened in the kind of, you know, and again, in my personal capacity, is Donald Trump for sale. You have, you know, Trump railing against TikTok, railing against China. And then he meets with a billionaire who might be able to help him, you know, help him with his finances in some form or another. And suddenly he's not in favor of regulating TikTok. Now, the related thing that I think is worth understanding, at least I thought was, you know, very concerning, is that you in the same time as he's apparently desperate for cash, suddenly there's this notion that he's going to take Truth Social public.
Yes.
And the valuation on it was insane. It's like if I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you sort of thing. Like,
right. If he had brought this on Shark Tank, Kevin O'Leary, who's been singing his praises and defending this nonsense, would say you're out of your fucking mind.
I mean, the valuation was like truly jaw-dropping. And that was because, you know, it was clear that this operation has not, you know, it's clear this operation has not made money or, you know, has been having losses. But then, of course, just this past week, they had to do some financial filing as part of the due diligence. And in fact, like, not just that we all suspected that they were losing money or there were indications of them losing money, but in fact, they have lost money. How can a company, True Social, that, you know, has been a loser, you know, in so many ways, how can Posse valued at this billion, like making Trump a billionaire?
Billions, right.
Other than by basically some people, and I'm not saying yes to this, I think this is, you know, a broader phenomenon happening, but, you know, basically trying to blow the price of that stock up, almost like what we were seeing with, you know, some of these, you know, some of the
real estate holdings,
other, you know, some of the other Bitcoin, not Bitcoin itself,
gotcha.
Like some of these things where there was an effort to like raise the price up, and then all the big cats bailed out, and then all the little investors lost their shirts.
The meme
one of those,
stocks,
you know,
what they call like the game, GameStop thing.
GameStop.
Right.
Yeah, GameStop. Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Wow. Because what we learned was
like a pump and dump. Basically, it seemed like a pump and dump to me on Truth Social. Yeah.
And yesterday or Monday, sorry, the day's running together, when it started publicly trading over the course of the day, it dropped like 21%. And then the financials were released and we learned that there was like $4 million in revenue, but something like, you know, tens of millions of dollars in losses. So how they came up with a valuation in the billions, no idea. And this,
Same.
Donald Trump couldn't sell his options or his stock because of regulations, but I guess that's enough to get someone else to lend him the money, knowing that allegedly he could cover it. Although the value could keep dropping, and maybe he can't. But we know more now than we knew that he's nowhere near as wealthy as he claimed to be when he first came down those steps at Trump Tower and said, "I don't need anybody's money. I'll do it all myself."
Well, you know, one of the things that is astonishing to me, and in my personal capacity, this whole, you know, second part of this conversation post Raga, like I get all these appeals from the Trump machine. I get all these texts from them. You know, I'm signed up for all the different lists, and I'm getting like an appeal like a day, a couple times a day from Trump. Today I got an appeal from Trump saying, "Wait, I'll read it to you because it's just quite astonishing." The latest one is, "Dear Lisa, I'm inviting you to the Trump Advisory Board." Yesterday, I got an appeal from him that said, and I'm going to quote because it's just so outrageous, from Trump, "I've been thinking about Lisa. You mean everything to me. So I wrote you a letter," and then you click it open and it literally says, I will never stop loving you. Your support means everything to me. I'm writing this letter because I know you're a top patriot, and through thick and thin, you've always known that I've always known that you never give up. Thank you. Keep fighting to save America. And then it's like a fundraising appeal from Trump.
Right.
And so like they are regularly appealing to ordinary people who may not fully understand somehow what a scam this is, in my opinion. It's obviously not a scam in the sense that it's actually going to fund his campaign, and that's what they want to do. But this idea that Trump loves you,
yes,
that Trump's inviting you to be on his advisory committee. For a while there, I was getting notes from Donald Trump Jr. saying, Lisa, I'm about to go on stage and hand my father a list of people who are donors. Can I make sure your name is on that list? He'll see your name.
Oh,
or, Lisa, Trump wants to have dinner with you. One of my friends called it like this weird sort of, stalking. Although obviously I've signed up for it, but it appeals to a particular mentality of people who, you know, maybe they've never before now we haven't received messages, quote,
right,
from a president. They're not from him, obviously, they're from his fundraising machine, but they're very personalized. And I think in my personal view, he's really preying on people, some people who may be quite vulnerable.
Oh, without a doubt.
To be persuaded by this idea that Trump cares for them, that Trump loves them, that Trump wants their advice. He wants their money. That's
mm-hmm.
what he wants.
Right. Right. The whole thing, you know, it's this, that fawning, that, you know, the I love you kind of stuff. That's really creepy. Yes, it is a form of stalking, but it's also, you know, it preys on it, just like, the televangelists who would bilk old people out of their life savings, you know, send money and we'll make sure that you're saved and you go to heaven or whatever they say. You know, they tread on the neediest, most vulnerable people in society. And that's what he's doing. You know, he probably got a lot of people who didn't have much money to invest in this Truth Social bullshit, and they're going to lose their life savings. And he doesn't care because, right? He can pull out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like this idea, and it's obviously what these memes on Facebook that resonate, but it's like a billionaire does not need to ask you for money.
That's right.
The idea that he every day using these people as an ATM is just, you know, it's really extraordinary. But also it is culty. You know, it is this cultish behavior that he's created, this cult of personality around himself. And there are some people who are, you know, I guess desperate to be part of the Trump club, who like the women for Trump,
yep,
who show up and are all fawning to get a picture with him, despite his record of, you know, how many the proven record of E. Jean Carroll,
yes,
and then the other allegations of his sexual, you know, sexually predatory behavior, or the idea, again, speaking in my personal capacity, that this guy is hawking a Bible, you know, the same guy who was cheating on his wife, his second wife, who he, you know, or third wife, pardon me, who was, you know, who had been
just
who was
had
pregnant
a baby, right,
and was cheating on, you know, I mean, or just had a baby, and you have, you know, this guy who I, you know, there's the thou shalt not lie, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit false witness,
he's
thou shalt not commit adultery.
Bible.
Like step four,
right,
of the 10 commandments,
yep,
right there.
Right. No, it's astounding. And so today, I guess this was today or yesterday, you know, I had made a concerted effort. Actually, it was easy once he was out of office to never play his voice on this air again and to just ignore him. Thank you, know, because I waited 4 years for that day to come. But now he is the presumptive Republican nominee against all common sense. And so we have to play these clips because it's important that people know who this guy is. Now, Lisa Graves, a moment ago, we talked about the attorneys general, the top-ranking law enforcement officials in states. He's at an event, I'm putting up a video in a moment, in Michigan, surrounded by people in uniform, like police officials and such. And I just want, this is a really quick clip, but I want you to hear what he said while he's got all of these law enforcement officials behind him.
Best election we ever have, that's where our country's going.
Oops.
Because if we don't win on November 5th, I think our country is going to cease to exist. It could be the last election we ever have. I actually mean that. We don't win. I think this could be the last election we ever have. That's where our country's going.
Okay, so that's if we don't win, this could be the last election this country ever has. That's where we're going. What? You have an idea of what he's saying there?
I actually think it's projection, because my concern is that, you know, personally, if he were to win, I don't know that he would allow there to be another election. He would just stay in office.
Yes.
He just said, you know, repeatedly that he thinks he's entitled to a third term or some sort of indefinite, you know, role.
Yep.
And since he barely left last time when he lost, I don't think we can have any confidence he would leave even when his term was up.
Right.
And, you know, and I guess the other thing I was going to say, I was just thinking about the Ten Commandments again, because I forgot one, which was, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. And, right. You know, there's the famous clip with Billy Bush where he's basically saying the woman he was, you know, moving on,
yep,
quote, like a bitch, you know, she's married. Sorry, I just had to mention that because I have missed, there's five of
That's
the Ten
right.
Commandments at least. but back to this issue, I mean, he's just lying to people. If Biden were to win this election on November 5th of 2024, you know, unless there was some sort of violent civil war that Trump stoked and took over the government, I would fully anticipate us to have a Democratic election in 2028 and 2032,
sure,
and so on. But with this guy and what he's done to try to stay in power at any cost, including unleashing people on the mall to attack the Capitol, to attack Mike Pence and more, I don't think anyone could have confidence that he would leave power, that he would allow there to be another election,
right,
another presidential election in America.
And
that's my personal view.
I agree. And I think the other thing he's saying there is, if he's not elected, if he doesn't win, well, of course, that means it was stolen. And my people will take to the country this time, not just the Capitol building. And
yeah, I mean, I just think it's just so reckless. It's so selfish. It's so destructive. And in fact, his description of America and America in the last 4 years is just so out of whack with reality in terms of the economy, in terms of, you know, what's happening, you know, people's lives. This idea that this is a Marxist country, I mean, it's totally ahistorical, ridiculous. It's practically obscene to claim that about America. And yet he keeps fueling just this complete disinformation, dystopian nonsense. And some of his followers eat it up. However, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me in watching the primary results is that in many states, he barely won half the vote. He barely won half the vote in Iowa.
Yep.
He barely won half the vote in a number of other states. And yet some of these reporters, as you and I talked about, I think a couple times ago, were writing like how he had the biggest margin in Iowa. He had the biggest margin because there were only three viable candidates.
Right.
And he only got half the vote.
That's right.
And he's effectively the incumbent in a sense. And so, in fact, the fact that actually in many of the states where there were primaries, almost half his party didn't vote for him. I mean, he seems to be operating from a position of real weakness, but he certainly has some very zealous followers who, you know, he may be playing this stochastic terrorism game that we've seen him play before, where he sort of gives a nod and a wink to violence.
Yes. Absolutely. I have no doubt about that. And I find it frightening, and I found it rather even more frightening that he was surrounded by law enforcement people as he said those words. And I didn't see anyone move to say, don't threaten political violence, sir. Nobody did. So there's that, which is, you know, just frightening. There's so many other things. I'm looking at something else. He did an event in Columbia, South Carolina at the Black Conservatives fundraiser or something. And what he said was there, and in deference to Kate in the chat room, who said, please don't play his voice anymore. He said, I'll do it in his voice. Would you rather have the Black president or the white president? I think they want the white guy. The man has no filters.
I missed that.
Okay, well then
entirely.
Hold on. I'm going to play it for so you can actually hear the words.
I'm sorry, Kate.
Kate'll deal. It's 14 seconds. Hold on. 14 seconds. Okay.
white president who got $1.7 billion off the price. I think they want the white guy right now.
Yeah. Here.
Would you rather have the black president or the white president who got $1.7 billion off the price?
Ick. Does he think he thinks he's running against Barack Obama? Or, you know, it all just makes no sense whatsoever. It's just ugly. Everything about the man is ugly. And here's the next segue, Lisa Graves. But this month, he goes to court. On October 15th, that's the date that the fraud trial begins in Manhattan with the judge whose daughter he has been threatening online. And the judge had to revise the gag order he originally put out to say specifically, you cannot talk about family members of any court personnel. And yet he did it again. So, Lisa, if this was a gag order against some no-name defendant in a trial, and they repeatedly thumbed their nose at orders from the judge, what would happen to that person?
Well, in general, if that were to happen, if it were the attorney or the client, they would possibly be facing contempt, citation, and consequences for contempt, which is typically being booked into going to jail.
Yeah. And Donald Trump says, they're not going to put me in jail because my people will take to the streets, so I'll just do what the hell I want. At least that's how it seems to me. Is that how it seems to you?
He certainly seems to be over a repeat offender in terms of violating court orders, violating the guidance from the court. And this is really ugly. I mean, there's so many components of the ugliness that he spews. And again, that's my personal opinion. But the fact is, or my opinion is, in essence, like, I cannot believe that anyone would be attacking or assailing the child of a judge,
right,
or the clerk of a judge. It's just so outside the bounds of what's normal, you know, in terms of the law, policy, civil society. But his the way that he's treated people, and this is even after his the way he and Rudy Giuliani treated the election workers, Ruby Freeman, her mother,
and Shea Moss, Georgia. Right.
And the consequences for their lives, the risk to their lives of this type of targeting. He knows, they know that when he names someone like that, that those people are face risk of death, you know, torture, dismemberment, rape by some of his unhinged followers who then take those names of those people and threaten their lives and the lives of their family members.
Yep.
And it's just, it's so appalling. It's so reckless. And anyone else who behaved this way during a legal process would, in fact, in my view, be held in contempt. And that contempt citation would be upheld on appeal because it is just so far out of bounds.
And yet he keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. By the way, this is a complete non sequitur, but I got to ask about this. Sorry, Kate. I'm going to play one more clip because in this same appearance that he was at in Michigan with all the law enforcement people behind him, he goes off on a tangent about the electric car, right? And but he uses a word. It's like he makes up his own language. Listen to this and tell me if you ever heard this type of use for the word push. Here's the clip.
This, and the first day, I promise you, I will sign with the electric.
Sorry, I'm trying to. Here we go.
Is gone. If you want an electric car, you can buy it, but you're going to be able to buy every other form of push, other form of car and engine and motor that you want, and you're going to have this. And the first day, I promise you, okay, I will sign where the electric vehicle mandate is gone. If you want an electric car, you can buy it, but you're going to be able to buy every other form of push.
Of push? Do you know what he's talking about there? Does he just make words up?
I mean, it's really incoherent, and yet he's the guy who has assailed, you know, Biden's stutter repeatedly, has tried to pillory Biden, who was, you know, in my opinion, in tremendous form during the State of the Union address in terms of just really filled with fire and speaking compellingly and on an impromptu basis, dealing with the hecklers from the Republican caucus.
Yep.
But here you have Trump, and also like this idea, like no one is required to buy an electric vehicle.
No, right.
There are incentives to buy electric vehicles because of the consequences of gasoline vehicles in terms of climate and our, you know, effort to mitigate climate change. But this hostility to electric vehicles is astonishing, and in fact most countries are, you know, rapidly expanding. You know, people in the other countries are rapidly expanding. In the United States, many people are pursuing electric vehicles because it makes sense.
Of course,
it helps save the environment. In fact, it also, you know, you can just plug your car in, and some of these utilities are getting some of their energy increasingly from wind and solar. And so it just makes sense. Why would we not use clean energy like wind and solar to help run our utilities and then be able to power our houses and our cars?
Of course.
You know, from that clean energy. And, you know, it can be expensive for some of those vehicles. So there have been some subsidies or some, you know, incentives for doing so. But this is an irrational hostility against these alternative fuels, which, can help us, not entirely, but can't wean us off this extreme dependence on fossil fuels.
Right. No, I mean, it makes no sense. And his whole, you know, obviously he's sucking up to the gas, the oil and gas companies. But the making up of words, as you said, this is somebody who criticizes Joe Biden for his stutter. He mocked him like a stutter in a speech after the State of the Union. Sorry, that State of the Union address was pretty stellar. And I'd put it up against any of the four that Trump delivered. If anyone remember him giving Rush Limbaugh the Medal of Honor during a State of the Union address? It's like it's a perversion of American history and norms and everything else. But anyway, what I was saying before is, so he goes to court in 2 weeks. He'll be in Judge Merchan's courtroom after threatening the judge's daughter and thumbing his nose at his authority. And then while that's going on, about a week after that, so that starts on the 15th, and then on the 25th, 10 days later, the Supreme Court, for its final case of the year, will hear Donald Trump's claims of absolute immunity. Is that something that even exists in the Constitution or in American law?
No, it does not. And in fact, the Constitution doesn't mention presidential immunity anywhere. And to the extent the U.S. Supreme Court has considered claims of presidential immunity, for example, predominantly in the Nixon cases, it did not find that there was any unlimited immunity. And one of the real truisms of American, you know, America as a democracy, as a nation of the rule of law, not men, is that no person is above the law. The fact that this court that has been packed by Trump with the advice of Leonard Leo has taken this case is quite disturbing, because the lower court, the D.C. Circuit, issued an opinion. It was an opinion by three judges who were appointed by presidents of both parties, and they resoundingly rejected the claims of Trump to this sort of unlimited immunity. And so the easiest thing for this court to have done, the Supreme Court to have done, would have been to not take the case.
Exactly.
To let the ruling stand by the D.C. Circuit. But instead, they took the case. Now they've intervened in a way that delays justice.
Yep.
And every single day that they are not hearing that case and not issuing a ruling is delaying justice for the American people. It is genuinely outrageous that they have played this role, that they've taken on this case. And we don't know when they're going to issue the decision and what they're going to decide, because this court has proven itself, in my opinion, to be untrustworthy. It destroyed nearly 50 years of legal precedent in Roe. It destroyed, longstanding rules in terms of separation of church and state. It has destroyed a key enforcement provision of the Voting Rights Act. I am very concerned about what this faction that Trump and Leo put onto the court will do in this immunity case and how that will affect the ability of that case to go forward, as it most surely should go forward, in the District of Columbia, the court where that case was filed. It must go forward for the sake of our democracy, for the integrity of our democracy.
Right. Now, Lisa, we've seen the Supreme Court can act quickly. Back in 2000 with Bush v. Gore, they got on it. They did what they heard what they needed to hear. They ruled stupidly and wrongly, but they issued a ruling and they did it really fast. In this case, they tacked as you just mentioned, they could have just taken the appeals court's very well thought out opinion that was written by the three judge panel together that covered all the bases, but no, they didn't. They said, we'll hear it. They tack it on at the very end of the term to make it the last case. And as you said, they usually hand down those the big decisions at the very end of June, sometimes going off over into July. And just going by their MO, it looks like that's what they're doing. They're playing Donald Trump's game of delay, delay, delay.
Well, and once the court takes that case, who knows, quite frankly, what machinations could ensue from Sam Alito or Clarence Thomas to drag their feet in terms of actually issuing a decision in that case, whether they're in the majority or in the minority in that case. And, in the Nixon cases, those cases were heard promptly by the Supreme Court, as you mentioned, in Bush v. Gore, even though the result was abominable in terms of, intervening in the legitimate recount in the Florida election. They heard the case and ruled quickly.
Yep.
But here they're already going slowly. And the people of this country cannot wait for justice any longer in these cases. These cases are of paramount importance, again, for protecting the integrity of our election system from the type of behavior that the charges describe Trump having committed, and which I believe he indeed committed.
Exactly. So now, with all the, the fix, the one remedy that is a legal option, there's no number of Supreme Court justices expressed anywhere in the Constitution. It's whatever it is. It's been more than nine before. It's been less. They could expand the court, as they did with the districts, have enough justices to correlate with the various district courts. Just one idea. But what's come out in the last few days is a lot of Democrats calling for Justice Sotomayor to step down now so Joe Biden can nominate her replacement. What do you think about this?
Well, it sounds like there are people who have concerns about her health and whether she would be able to serve another full presidential term.
Yeah.
I don't know her health. I'm not privy to that information. And I think there's a lot of wariness because of what happened
with Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
She did not step down during the Obama administration, even though she had struggled with cancer in the past and other health issues. She stayed on and then, as we all know, died, right before the 2020 election in September. And the Republicans pushed through Amy Coney Barrett in a matter of weeks as people were already voting in that election to ultimately defeat Donald Trump.
That's right.
And put her in power, put her on the Supreme Court, in my view, illegitimately, even though they refused to move President Obama's nominee months.
For almost a year.
And so there, because Scalia died in February of 2016, and they refused to hold a hearing for Merrick Garland for Obama's nominee. And so, you have a situation where there, because of the nature of the court, the variability of fate, in essence. There are people who have expressed concerns about that, and obviously this is a human being, an ordinary person who's also Supreme Court justice, to have this sort of speculation about your health, in the public domain would obviously be concerning to you and the people who love you. And yet, as with Ginsburg and others, on the court over time, it is a matter of public concern because of the consequences of what can happen depending on who's president when a vacancy arises.
Right.
I think there needs to be a whole set of reforms to address the needs to reform this court, to restore it to its proper role in our society, and to not have it playing this extremist role of basically politicians in robes advancing Leonard Leo's extreme agenda from the bench, or the agenda of his billionaire backers and buddies from the bench. But one of those things that needs to change, I think, is the term limits and the size of the court, so that we're not in a situation where the court, the makeup of the court, is just dependent on the confluence of, you know, who's president, who controls the Senate right at that time. For example, President Carter served for 4 years, had no vacancies.
Wow.
Then Reagan served for 8 years. I think he had five vacancies if you count the chief justice, you know, kind of O'Connor, Kennedy, Scalia, Rehnquist, maybe four at that time. And then George Herbert Walker Bush in 4 years had two vacancies come up.
Huh.
But then Clinton had 8 years and only two vacancies in the course of 8 years, and they were at the beginning.
Yeah.
So it is very random, and that randomness, I guess, would be okay if the judges were acting as judges.
Right.
And genuinely following the law. But instead, this court has been targeted for capture by the right wing in order to change our rights, limit our rights, and to do so through, you know, taking advantage of these, you know, vacancies as they arise in this random way. And then also, you know, for that court and lower courts, choosing people who are very young for the court.
Yes.
So, for example, when Clinton had those two vacancies early in his term, Orrin Hatch, in his autobiography, claims that he urged the Republican caucus to approve Ginsburg and Breyer because they were old.
Oh, God.
And they would only serve for 20, 25 years. And that, in fact, turned out to be true. And he basically, his argument was, but we'll appoint younger people.
And
like
they
Thomas,
did.
Who was in his early 40s.
Right.
And
Amy Coney Barrett.
And Roberts.
Roberts and Kavanaugh. All of them,
yeah,
they're young.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's their strategy, is to game the system, to put super young, you know, hardliners, people who are devoted to their extreme agenda on the court for decades, like 10, like not just two decades,
right,
but like 30 years,
right,
40 years
or more
on the court, and to control that court in order to advance their extreme regressive agenda. And that's how they've approached the court. We need massive reform to protect our rights.
And how could that happen? We've only got like a minute or two left, but is this something Joe Biden could enact, could say, okay, we've got to get the Supreme Court back to supreme instead of extreme, and here's what we're going to do?
It's going to require, in my personal view, it's going to require a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate,
yep,
in order to get the reforms needed. It cannot happen in this term with the,
yep,
House controlled by the Republicans. You know, so nothing can happen. No change, no reform could happen this year. But if there were a surge in progressive voting and voters and a result in terms of the House and the Senate and the White House, then we would have a chance to reform this court. And so in my personal view, like, that's what needs to happen to reform this court.
We've got our marching orders. You know, we hear it every 4 years. This is the most important election of our lifetimes. I've never meant it more than I do now. And I meant it every time I've said it in the past. But the floor keeps dropping below us. So,
yeah,
there's so much at stake. Like, everything is at stake. All elections are important. This one blows the roof off the sucker. So,
well, yeah. And one of my friends sent out a meme that said, you know, an election isn't a Valentine. It's a chess move.
Huh?
And so, you know, what is the chess move we need to make to protect our rights, to protect from this rising fascism, from losing our democracy to these extremists? In my, you know, personal view, again, that choice is clear. That choice is clear.
Without a doubt. Lisa Graves, this hour flew by. I so appreciate it when you come on. And as do the listeners. It's so funny. As I was signing on, the chat was just starting and someone's like, oh, Lisa Graves. Yay. I love her. So that's always the reaction I get when you're the guest. So thank you. And thank you for checking in from the road and for all you do. I so appreciate your input and your availability to us. So thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Nicole. All right. Thanks, listeners.
Okay. Talk to you soon. We'll talk soon. Bye. Bye. Tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. Okay. And I've got a lot of stuff to tell you at the beginning of the show. What we had a whole hour here. So tomorrow and then Friday, Marcy Wheeler. Sounds pretty good to me. The rest of the week, I could live with it. All right. Until then, peace out, everyone.